The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop looking out over London.
Good night and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
And we made it to another Friday, and I think we should take a moment of self-congratulations for that, because in this day and age, you never know. I consider it an achievement when we get to the end of another week. Thankfully, Stephen Colbert is back on the job, so we'll start with a bit of funny from the master himself.
Then Trump fanned the flames of the crowds. Would you believe economic anxiety?
I have a suggestion for the hate-filled extremists who are constantly trying to tear our country down.
Come to my rally. You'll fit right in.
Then he went on about the congresswoman.
They never have anything good to say. That's why I say, hey, if they don't like it, let them leave. Let them leave. If they don't love it, tell them to leave it.
So he said that these women should leave the country. Let's see if the crowd is able to pick up on that subtle messaging when he starts talking about Minnesota Congresswoman Ilhan Omar.
And she looks down with contempt on the hardworking Americans, saying that ignorance is pervasive in many parts of this country. And obviously and importantly, Omar has a history of launching vicious anti-Semitic screeds.
I never thought I'd say this, but these rallies where a nationalist leader whips people up into a racist frenzy might have a dark side. This chant did not help Trump's image as not a racist. So this afternoon, he tried to distance himself from his own idea.
Mr. President, if I may, when your supporters last night were chanting, send her back, why didn't you stop them? Why didn't you ask them to stop saying that?
Well, number one, I think I did. I started speaking very quickly.
No, you didn't.
Okay, so you started speaking very quickly to stop them from chanting. Let's see how very quickly you started.
And she talked about the evil Israel.
Okay. You didn't cut them off by talking. You let them fully get their hate rocks off. The reporter pressed him further.
So you'll tell your supporters never to say
that
again?
Well, I would say that. I was not happy with it. I disagree with it.
Bullshit.
But again, I didn't say that. They did.
Oi. Wow. Wow, Trump supporters, did you see him throw you under the bus? Probably not, since you have a tire on your face right now.
There's that.
And wait a second. Trump, you disagree with it? Hey, mister, this is your party. You're the bride at the white power wedding. And you sent out some lovely engraved invitation. Please join me on the dark side. Pick one, chicken, fish, or race war. And for Pete's sake, if you're going to be a demagogue, at least grow a pair and take responsibility for what you inspired them to chant, Mussolini.
Ooh.
Okay?
Mussolini? I like that one.
You created that crowd. You're like Dr. Frankenstein saying, I didn't strangle those villagers. It was my monster. All I did was sew together some dead bodies, zap it with lightning, deny it love, set it loose, and mention that I knew some people who could use a good strangling.
There you go. A little bit of Stephen Colbert, a slice a slice of Stephen from last night to get us going on this Friday show. Welcome to it. I'm Nicole Sandler, coming to you as I want to do every Tuesday through Friday, live at 3 Eastern. That would be noon Pacific. We're heard on the Progressive Voices Network at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 Pacific. And of course, whenever and wherever you choose to listen via the podcast, which is available through all the usual podcast outlets, you know, iTunes and all that, you can also always get it at NicoleSandler.com. It's always free, though I survive on your donations, so please be generous. Okay, so last night, oh my God, did you watch CNN? They had the big debate, draw! They built it up to be this big thing, and then they had three different news anchors shuffle these tiles with the camera. It was just absurd. It was so ridiculous. And so they came up with their divisions for who's going to be on night one, who's going to be on night two. The big news is it's going to be Bernie and Elizabeth Warren on night one, and a rematch of Kamala Harris and Joe Biden on night two. And pretty much the rest of the slate is irrelevant. But it's disturbing because, as you know, we had him on the show a few months ago after when he first announced his candidacy. Senator Mike Gravel is running. And last Thursday, we were talking about it on the show. He actually crossed the threshold, the threshold to compete in the debate. Let me read to you from the if I can find where I had the rules. Okay. Damn it. Well, what they say is you needed to qualify to have either 65,000 unique donors, with 200 of them coming from 20 states, or reach 1% in five polls that are on the official poll list. And, five qualifying polls by four different pollsters. Okay. So, Swalwell dropped out. Steve Bullock, the governor of Montana, got in. He qualified via the polling requirement. Okay. But then there's Mike Gravel. Mike Gravel got, well, you know what? Let's bring on Mike Gravel's national press secretary. Joining us on the line right now is Marlon Ettinger. Marlon, are you there?
Hey, Nicole, how are you?
I'm okay. Thank you so much for joining us today. I'm a little pissed off, frankly, over CNN's, not the fact that they've omitted Mike Gravel from the debate stage after he qualified, although I am kind of pissed about that, but they just disappeared him. I'm reading articles on their website about who qualified for the debates, and just Mike Gravel doesn't exist in their universe, it seems. How were you guys informed of this?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, CNN has never been very friendly toward us. You know, at the beginning of the campaign, they said they were going to offer a town hall to every candidate as well, but we contacted them plenty and they never did.
Wow.
So it didn't come as so much as a surprise. Of course, we were disappointed, but, you know, unfortunately, it wasn't a surprise. You mentioned those polls. You know, there were 26 DNC-approved polls since we started the campaign in April.
Yeah.
And we were only included on 14 of them.
You were included in 14 out of 26. I just want to make that clear, because this one article that I found at 538.com, which was, I think, the fairest on who's in and who's out of the second Democratic debate. I'll link to this article on my blog. Mm-hmm. You know, it does at least mention Mike Gravel and the fact that he did meet the threshold. It says, by our count, 21 candidates have qualified for the second debate by getting either 1% support in at least three qualifying national or early state polls conducted by different pollsters or in different demographics, or 65,000 unique donors, including at least 200 individual donors in at least 20 states. So there are 21 who qualified. So it says this means that there is one too many candidates for the second debate. The DNC has capped participation to 20, but there's not much suspense as to who's out.
out. This is, again, from 538. Former Alaska Senator Mike Gravel will not make the stage, even though he reportedly has hit the donor threshold, because the DNC's tiebreaker rules favor those who've met the polling requirement, and he's the only candidate who was qualified via donors alone. But was any mention made of the fact that he wasn't included in all these polls, in all 26 polls that they use as a benchmark?
Not that I've seen, no. And the polling, too, is, you know, there are five other candidates who were just qualified by polling alone.
Yeah.
Some of them have barely any donors, you know.
Right.
There's a reporting that John Hickenlooper has only 13,000 donors.
Oh, my God.
And I think, you know, I think the salient point is that the donor requirement really does show a grassroots base of support. And I think that this other polling criteria is a way to, you know, head that off.
Right.
Because
of course
you can get polling on just name recognition.
That's,
you know?
Right. And I would say that Mike Gravel has greater name recognition than Tim Ryan or John Hickenlooper or John Delaney. I mean, really, John Delaney? These are right. Tim Ryan, John Hickenlooper, John Delaney, Bill de Blasio, Steve Bullock, and Michael Bennett. All qualified only via the polling. They didn't make the 65,000 donor threshold. Now, look, none of those names I just rambled off are going to be president. None of them are going to be the nominee. Many are suggesting that some of them get the hell out of there already. John Hickenlooper, perhaps, and Michael Bennett maybe should be running for Senate. You know, I don't even know who
their staff have asked them. Supposedly, Hickenlooper's staff and Delaney's staff have both asked him.
Now, wow.
They denied it, of course. But
wow.
Not even their staff wants.
Yeah. So, and then there's Seth Moulton and Joe Sestak and Tom Steyer, the egomaniac, who didn't qualify on any front. Look, you know, there are those who complain, and someone in the chat room just said, well, Mike Gravel isn't even running seriously to win. He wants to get in on the conversation, which at this point, I mean, the debates are a free-for-all. There's all these people on it who don't have a chance in hell of ever getting the nomination, who shouldn't be on the stage. If John Delaney is going to be on the stage, then I want Mike Gravel on the stage. So CNN has spoken to you guys at all?
We used to say, we're running to win just as much as they are.
Right.
You know, it's a joke, but it's true.
So what are your plans? What are Senator Gravel's plans now? What do we do going forward?
Well, right now we're trying to get John Delaney to drop out, but that's not likely to happen. Going forward, we're going to try to, you know, get media around the debate. During the last debate, we got a lot of media, a lot of engagement on Twitter. We're actually going to try to be in Detroit, Senator Gravel. We're thinking of doing that.
Cool.
To try to get out the message that way. And then maybe, this is still early days, but we'll have to speed it up. We're planning on maybe holding a sort of a forum event in Detroit or Flint at the same time, or around the same time.
Okay, gotcha.
Talking about the issues that we want to get out there.
Well, good. I'm glad, because I want Mike Gravel's views heard. Marlon Ettinger, I know the campaign is being run by a couple of high school seniors, I believe. Are you a high school student as well?
I'm not. I'm the ancient member of the team. I'm at 24.
Uh-huh.
They're actually out of high school now,
okay.
But only a year or two.
Gotcha. Okay, well, I love that they've taken this on, and I love this insurgency campaign that you guys are running, and I think Mike Gravel's views need to be heard. It's why I loved having him on the show, and I'm glad he's making his voice heard. You know, shame on CNN, shame on the DNC, who I'm sure were every bit as much part of the decision as CNN was, if not more so. It's just the way they roll, and that's
exactly
the problem.
Exactly. You know, we tried contacting them. I think we counted over 100 phone calls very early on to try to get in touch with them, and they never got in touch with us.
Meaning
very recently.
CNN or the DNC?
The DNC.
Wow. They've learned nothing in the last 4 years. Nothing.
Well, that's who they are.
That's who they are. Marlon, thank you so much. Is this your first foray into the world of electoral politics, or are you a veteran?
Into electoral politics, yeah.
All
oh,
right.
No, I'm not a veteran. You know, I always say politics is for perverts and losers. And this campaign With most of the candidates, that's true. But yeah. I think that Mike Gravel and a couple other people on the stage would have been the only authentic people up there.
Yeah. Well, there are a few. Thankfully, there are a few. And hopefully the field will be winnowed down quickly to the worthy candidates. Because, you know, if there's going to be 20 people on the stage, I want Mike Gravel there. If they're going to be serious about it, all right, give us Bernie and Elizabeth Warren and I'll be happy. Marlon, thank you so much. I'm gonna move on. I appreciate you jumping on with us and you know, explaining as best you could what went on. Unbelievable. Thank
Good
you.
Talking.
All right, you too. Bye. Take care. Bye bye. All right, there you have it from the Mike Gravel campaign. DNC wouldn't even talk to them. CNN didn't even talk to them. And these articles on CNN.com. Just this is what riles me up. Totally ignore him. There were 20 who qualified. No, there were 21. Mike Gravel exists, and they're disappearing him. They've learned nothing. All right. This has been a week, and I know I think I say that every Friday, but it just goes from what's the old cliche, from the sublime to the ridiculous. Again, if the events of this week were written in a screenplay, no movie studio would greenlight the project because they'd say it's too inconceivable. This could never happen. Well, we're living it, everyone. All right. We do have an amazing guest coming on today. I've been looking forward to speaking with this guy since the first time I saw him on television. Eli Mestal is he is the editor of Above the Law, AboveTheLaw.com, and a contributing writer for The Nation, where he has the cover story on the July 29th issue, which is all about Trump's packing of the courts. And it's a really, probably the most important thing that he's done. It's the thing that he's done that will have the most lasting impact on this country and fuck us over in a big way. And he's still got 18 months left to do it. So we'll talk with Eli Mestal about that because it is that important. But let's move on. And I know I covered much of it. Well, Stephen Colbert covered much of it. But let's get on with the rest of the news, shall we? Oh, it would help if I turned the volume up. I read the news today, oh boy. All right. Well, you know, my What's News copy starts with the whole center back chant. But I will say Stephen Colbert covered it. Right. And we don't need to deal with that again. It's sickening enough as it is. So let's start with Ilhan Omar returning home to Minneapolis yesterday, at where she's greeted by a crowd at the airport. Welcome home, Ilhan, they're chanting.
I was the hope of the United States is because right. I embody what that hope should look like. And when I said I was the president's nightmare, well, you're watching it now. Because his nightmare is seeing a Somali immigrant refugee rise to Congress. Is seeing the beautiful mosaic fabric of our country welcome someone like me as their member of Congress home to Minnesota. And so we are going to continue to create that hope.
We have your back.
And we are going to continue to be a nightmare to this president because his power. Because his policies are a nightmare to us.
That's right.
And we are not deterred. Right. We are not frightened.
Right.
We are ready.
Yes.
We are in the ring. We are in the people's house. And we are going to continue to keep fighting until we have the America we know we all deserve. Thank you.
Good for her. So that's Ilhan Omar at the airport, arriving home in Minneapolis yesterday to a wonderful greeting, apparently. It kind of got under Trump's skin this morning. Aw, poor baby. Went on a Twitter spree. He was upset because she had people meet her at the airport. There was a House Oversight Committee hearing yesterday dealing with the conditions at the U.S.-Mexico border, you know, in the detention facilities that hold migrants, Chairman Elijah Cummings went off on Acting Homeland Security Secretary Kevin McAleenan, I think is how you say his name. It went on for more than 10 minutes. Obviously, I'm not going to play all 10 minutes of it, but here's a taste of the very, very much deserved tongue lashing.
When we hear about stories coming out from you and your agency that everything is pretty good and you're doing a great job, I guess you feel like you're doing a great job, right? Is that what you're saying?
We're doing our level best in a very
challenging. What does that mean? What does that mean when a child is sitting in their own feces, can't take a shower? Come on, man.
Come on, man.
What's that about?
What is
None of us would have our children in that position. They are human beings. And I'm trying to figure out, and I get tired of folks saying, oh, they just beating up on the Border Patrol. Oh, they just beating up on Homeland Security. Now, what I'm saying is I want to concentrate on these children. And I want to make sure that they are okay. I will say it, I've said it before, and I'll say it again. It's not the deed that you do to a child, it's the memory. Mm. It's the memory. And so, I told the head of Border Patrol the other day, I said, I want to know what's happening in the meantime. We are the United States of America. We are the greatest country in the world.
Well.
We are the ones that can
not anymore.
Go anywhere in the world and save people.
Not anymore.
Make sure that they have diapers.
Not
Make
anymore.
Make sure that they have toothbrushes.
Yeah, not
Make
anymore.
Sure that they're not laying around defecating in some silver paper. Come on.
Come on. Elijah Cummings, you rocked it, man. Come on, man.
Come on, man.
Come on, man.
Come on, man. I make light, but my God, good for him. And the guy, the acting Homeland Security chief, McAleenan, acting again, yeah, they're all acting in their roles, looked like he was about to cry. Good. I hope you cry. You should cry yourself to sleep every fucking night. Because you know those kids do. Those kids that you took from their parents who are sitting in their own shit, in their own sweat, who can't brush their teeth, who can't take a shower. Shame on you. Elijah Cummings' outrage was warranted. Every ounce of it and then some. We no longer can hold our heads high around the world and say we're better than that. No, we're not. We're the worst. And it's all because of Donald Trump. All because of Donald Trump.
Come on, man.
And Joe Biden, you won't even go there. Come on, man. Ugh. Whew. All right. In other news, you know, those newly released FBI search warrants. Your blood pressure is going to rise with this one. Those search warrants that have now, the unredacted warrants have been released. A new document dump. They show Trump was very much involved late in the 2016 race in the hush money scheme to hide his alleged affair with adult film star Stormy Daniels and contain the fallout from related news stories. The documents mark the first time authorities identified Trump by name and alleged his involvement at key steps in the scheme. Trump, of course, publicly denied the affair. What else is new? He lies about everything else. And he denied making the payments. His former attorney, Michael Cohen, facilitated the payments and ended up pleading guilty to two campaign finance crimes, among others. He's serving 3 years in prison. But, and it's a big but, bigger than Donald Trump's ample ass. It's a giant but. The U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York has said it has closed its investigation into the matter. And previous reports say that no one from the Trump Organization would be charged. I'm pausing for dramatic effect here to let that sink in. No one from the Trump Organization is going to be charged? He broke the law. He made illegal slush fund payments to silence a porn star who he fucked. when his wife was home with a newborn child. And nobody's going to be charged here. John Edwards was charged for something similar, a campaign fund violation. This is reprehensible. And you know who oversees the Southern District of New York? Bill Barr. Yes, the Southern District of New York is under the auspices of the Department of Justice. And the so-called Attorney General is the guy who makes the final decisions. Now, whether or not he personally signed off, no one from Trump Organization is going to be charged here. I don't know for sure. I just say, you know, consider the players. He's already cleared the way for Donald Trump to get away with kind of murder. And Trump has said it himself. He could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and he'd be just fine. And now that he's got his own Roy Cohn, you know, playing the role of Attorney General, I'm speechless. It has rendered me speechless because the other thing I can do is scream and pull my hair out. Unfucking believable. Then there's this. Tensions with Iran continue to escalate. Trump and the Pentagon, this is a weird story. Trump and the Pentagon said the U.S. destroyed an Iranian drone that came within 1,000 yards of the USS Boxer. We talked about it yesterday. We had a listener in the chat room asked if Trump knew that it was an unmanned drone. Right. Well, the defense official said the drone wasn't exactly shot down, but it was destroyed by using electronic jamming. However, Iran's foreign minister denied that a drone had been lost, suggesting instead that the U.S. accidentally shot down one of its own. look at the players. Meanwhile, Iran says it seized an oil tanker that was carrying smuggled fuel and had 12 people on board. It's still not clear who owns that ship. Reports say it's a British tanker. Really? And someone's asking, was there really a drone? Pfft, who knows? Who knows? All right. Well, it is Friday, and it is the middle of July. And guess what? It's going to be a hot weekend, not only in the city, but across much of the country this weekend. A dangerous heat wave is threatening much of the continental U.S. More than 85% of the lower 48 will see temperatures above 90 degrees over the next couple of days. The Midwest baked yesterday. The worst heat, they say, will find its way today to the Northeast. Not only will there be record high temperatures set in some places during the day, there will be record highs at night, too. These extreme temperatures overnight are especially concerning because it means people's bodies and homes won't have the opportunity to cool off. Ay, ay, ay. All right. And that's a look at what's news for now. Obviously, I'm Nicole Sandler. As I always say at the end of the recorded What's News, if you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. As you know, my work is 100% listener supported. I don't have a paywall up, so the show is available to anyone and everyone who cares to listen to it. You can get the subscribe to the podcast. You can get it off the website. You can watch on YouTube. There's a myriad of ways to listen. There's only one way, though, that I earn a living, and that's when you donate to the program. It's all voluntary. It's like the old NPR model, except I don't run those, what they call underwriter messages, which are really commercials. We don't run commercials. And I don't ask you for money as much as I should, but I'm trying to vamp and kill time until it's time to call Ellie Mistal, because I can. I'm trying to think if there's anything else. You know what? Here, let me play while we're waiting, because I got another minute. I don't want to call him too early. Lindsey Graham, the most, what's the word to describe Lindsey Graham? A sycophant, sleazy, slimy. Creepy. So Lindsey Graham, who probably would not sidle up to Donald Trump in the way he has recently, if John McCain was still alive, was asked about the chant the other night, the send her back chant. And I'm going to play the clip for you, but here's what I want you to listen for. Lindsey Graham is saying Donald Trump's not a racist because if there was a Somali refugee wearing a MAGA hat, he wouldn't want that person to be kicked out of the country. So he only wants you kicked out of the country if you don't align with Trump politically. If you dare to criticize him, which is an American thing, you should be deported. And this is what Lindsey Graham is sticking up for? Uh-oh. Here we go. Come on, Lindsey. I think I didn't trim the beginning of it. Oh, man. Damn it. Okay, hold on.
Here's what I think. I think the president is playing on the 1968 love it or leave it. I've said before that if you're a Somali refugee wearing a MAGA hat, he doesn't want to send you back. You probably have dinner at the White House.
You probably have dinner at the White House.
That it's about the criticism and the critic, that the president believes that what they're doing is over the top. We're not running concentration
camps. Yes, we are running concentration camps, but that's besides the point, Linz. It's telling me that Donald Trump wants to persecute his political opponents. That is a sign of fascism. Lindsey Graham just put his seal of approval on a fascist dictatorship under Donald Trump. Gee, don't you feel better now? Oh, my God. All right. I don't know. I told you we have a guest, Ellie Mistal. I'm very excited to speak with Ellie Mistal. I usually, when I have a guest on the show, I send them a nice, you know, detailed email explaining that I work without a producer. And so when I call and get them on the line, we'll be live on the air. I totally forgot to do that with Ellie. I emailed him like 10 minutes ago, so I don't know if he even got the message. So we'll just, you know, we'll call him live on the air. Because, you know, that's how we roll. Anyway, Ellie Mistal. There he is, Ellie Mistal. It's Nicole Sandler calling. How are you doing today?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm great, too. And I'm really excited that you're on the show. I don't know if you got my email a few minutes ago where I was telling you that I work without a producer. So when I get you on the line, we'll be live on the air. So we're live on the air.
What's up?
You? You know, I got to say, you know, I have a love-hate relationship with cable news. But I got to tell you, when you come on my screen, I turn up the volume. I do.
I need it.
No, you kind of don't because you cut through anyway. But I appreciate your contributions because you always have something to say and you do it in an entertaining way, which I think is so important.
Thank you very much. Look, my theory, and it's because I've been a blogger for so long, my theory is always that, look, you've got a lot of choices with your eyeballs, right? You got a lot of things you got to do in your life. If you're going to listen to the news, especially if you're going to listen to the legal news, you deserve to be able to smile a little bit.
And it gets harder and harder with each passing day, knowing what the legal news that you're telling us about is.
Yeah, it's kind of all terrible.
Oh, my God.
You got to laugh sometimes to keep from crying.
Absolutely. It beats the alternative, as I say. So, Ellie Mistal, for those who don't know, is the executive editor of Above the Law at AboveTheLaw.com. He's a contributing writer for The Nation. As well as the legal editor of WNYC's More Perfect. You can see him a lot on MSNBC. He can be followed on Twitter at Ellie, E-L-I-E-N-Y-C. And again, as I said, one of the few pundits who I regularly turn up. So the reason, I actually sent you, you followed me on Twitter like a week or two ago, and I was so excited, and I direct messaged you, but I didn't hear back from you. And then when I saw that you wrote the title, the cover story for the new issue of The Nation, and it's a really important subject, I jumped at the chance to have you on, so thank you so much for being here today. So this cover story, the July 29th issue of The Nation, is entitled Donald Trump and the Plot to Take Over the Courts. This is possibly the most important story surrounding Donald Trump's legacy that gets very little to no play in the media. I mean, even during the election, the specter of Trump packing the courts was never really raised as an issue by the Democrats. And by contrast, I still have a button from 2012. It was an Obama campaign button produced by People for the American Way that said, "It's the Supreme Court, stupid." The Democrats didn't even go there really during the campaign. Is this something that could have been avoided?
Yes, look, I think it's political malpractice. The fact that Merrick Garland's name was not mentioned once during the Democratic National Convention in 2016 was political malpractice. And it happens because the Democrats are so afraid of the issues that the Supreme Court generally rules upon, the hot button issues. The Republicans are they're so afraid of the Republican motivation to take away a woman's right to choose and to stop affirmative action or whatever it is that Republicans think they're getting with the courts. The Democrats are so afraid of that they're unwilling or unable to fight for what they believe in, to fight for the kind of judges and for the kind of legal decisions that they think are important. And it really is one of the many reasons that we are behind the ball on this critical issue. So, yeah, we have judges that we want to appoint and that we have legal issues that we want to advance, but we don't advocate for that. We don't explain to our voters how important that is. We don't explain to young people who care about climate change that there's nothing you can't do anything about climate change unless you control the courts. We don't explain to young people who care about gun regulations that you can't do anything about gun regulation unless you control the courts as well. So it's malpractice, I think.
It is malpractice. And you mentioned it's malpractice on the part of the Democratic Party. I get a lot of heat for criticizing Obama too much, but it's what I do. How did Barack Obama let his 8 years as president end with 106 judicial vacancies? And even more horrendous, Mitch McConnell stole a Supreme Court seat from Obama and handed it to Trump.
So my criticism of Obama here is real, but a little bit lighter.
Okay.
Because there is a sense that, like, you don't blame the homeowner because the arsonist burnt down his house, right?
True, Okay.
There's a victim here, and there's a skilled legal arsonist here, and that is Mitch McConnell.
Yes.
Mitch McConnell blocked Barack Obama appointees at every level for his entire 8 years, even when McConnell was in the minority. And that's not all Obama's fault. That is Mitch McConnell simply willing to throw out the playbooks, willing to throw out the norms, willing to throw out the rules, and do truly unprecedented things to block Obama appointees. And so there is that. Now, at some point when it became obvious that that was what McConnell was going to do, so I think Obama and the Democratic administration in general should have been a little bit quicker on the ball. Absolutely. Do I think that we were prepared when we could have been prepared for what McConnell was really about? Yeah, I think that was a bit of a missed opportunity. But the other way that I kind of criticize Obama is to really criticize the entire Democratic Party here. The progressives in general, the Democrats especially, have dropped the ball on the courts for so long that we're fighting an asymmetrical war, right? The Republicans have been planning the conservative takeover that we see today for 30 years. I mean, you said it exactly right. When Obama left office, there were 106 judicial vacancies open for the next president to fill. Now, I don't know if that's a record because, you know, George Washington, like, probably had a lot of appointees. But in modern times, that's ridiculous, right?
It is.
But the other part of it is that with 106 vacancies, Mitch McConnell and the Federalist Society and other conservative think tanks were ready with 200 judges to fill those 106 vacancies. If you hand the next Democratic president 106 vacancies, we don't got 106 judges ready to go. We got like 25, 30. And that's because we have not done the organizational work necessary to identify, incubate, train, promote, and advance the kinds of judges that we would want to have on these courts.
Right. And Ellie Mistal, as you point out in this brilliant, great, must-read piece at The Nation, the Federalist Society is basically doing all of the, I was going to say vetting, they're not vetting anyone, the compiling of the lists of their approved judicial nominees, most of which are totally unqualified for any bench position. I mean, like, look at some of the names of people who've been nominated. You know, people who've never tried a case ever, nominated for a federal judgeship. I mean, this is the kind of stuff on and on constantly.
To be a conservative judge, an appointee, you have to be a member at this point of the Federal Society or have the Federal Society's approval before you are able to advance to the bench.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side, even though the Federal Society is this, like, kind of crazy libertarian, arch-conservative legal organization, like, Republicans will not nominate you and will not confirm you if you don't have their stamp of approval. On the other end, if you're, to the extent that there's a Democratic equivalent to the Federal Society, there's not really,
right,
but the American Constitution Society tries to do what it can with much less funding. But one of Obama's appointees, Goodwin Liu, for the Ninth Circuit, he was knocked back because he was associated with the AC, with the American Constitution Society.
Oh, God.
Obama eventually decided not to back that nominee after Republicans gave him too much trouble. So again, this is an issue where, like, Democrats have not been willing to fight for what we believe, and the Republicans absolutely are willing to fight for what they believe. They've been doing this for a generation.
Absolutely.
The Federal Society is funded by, you know, name an important Republican donor and they donate to the Federal Society.
The Koch brothers, the Mercers.
The Gates Foundation,
right.
The Mercer family.
Yep.
You know, they're all in there. What do Democratic billionaires do?
they run for president.
Exactly. They run these egotistical campaigns for president or try to figure out how to go to the damn moon.
Yeah.
Like, instead of like buying the courts, Dahlia Lithwick, which I know
she's
you read,
awesome,
but like hope
right?
your listeners you like read her. She's great. She writes for Slate.
Yep.
She has this line that I've been using. It actually is not very expensive to buy a Supreme Court. Federal Society only got about $250 million, which in American politics these days, that's not a lot of money. If we donated money and put money into our judicial action networks, we might one day be able to match what the Federal Society has, but it's going to take, again, a focus of the entire progressive movement on this issue, and we just don't have that right now.
No, good luck to us. So, Ellie Mastal, you had... Trump has 18 months left in office, and that people like me are praying, even though I'm not a praying person. I send good thoughts for Ruth Bader Ginsburg to stay healthy. So in this story for The Nation, you name seven judges who are waiting in the wings. You call them the seven injustices. These are the people from whom, if, God forbid, Trump gets another Supreme Court seat to fill, he will likely draw from. You read through your descriptions of these, and it's like one is worse than the next. These are the reprehensibles. These are the deplorables. I mean, it just is mind-blowing that these people are waiting in the wings, and one of them could be the next Supreme Court justice. Tell us about some of these people.
Yeah, so one of the things I've tried to explain or expose to people is that we all know Republicans have promised that the kinds of judges they will appoint are judges who are against Roe v. Wade, who are against the women's right to choose. And so we kind of all, and Trump has absolutely made good on that threat.
Mm-hmm.
He has nominated hardcore anti-choice judges up and down the system. But people don't understand that if you are an anti-choice judge, that means that you believe all of these other horrible things that lead into you eventually getting to the point where you can overturn settled Supreme Court precedent like Roe v. Wade. So if you're kind of anti-abortion, you're probably also anti-LGBT rights, you're probably also anti-transgender rights, you're probably also anti-voting rights, pro-Second Amendment, pro-death penalty, on and on and on it goes. So like when you say you're nominating anti-abortion judges, you're nominating a whole lot more than that. And that's one of the things my piece has tried to explain. When you get into the actual kind of people, especially in the context of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the one that the conservatives want to replace her is a woman named Amy Coney Barrett.
Oh, God. And she was floated last time. Her name was, she was one of the finalists being floated when they picked Kavanaugh.
She makes conservatives giddy. And the reason why is that because of her judicial philosophy, which is heavily religious-based, heavily against precedent, which is a problem, suggests to them that she will absolutely be willing to overturn Roe v. Wade. Now, like I said, most of these people would be willing to overturn Roe v. Wade, but what they particularly like about her, and this is not me projecting, this is not me playing identity politics, this is what they've literally said. They have literally said they prefer Amy Coney Barrett to overturn Roe v. Wade because they want a woman to do it.
Oh, God.
Because somehow, in the way that Republicans think, if a woman crushes women's rights, then it's like, I don't know, okay, or like we won't notice or we won't criticize. I have no idea where this comes from, but we know that Republicans do, where they can, like to find a member of the oppressed community to join into the oppression. That basically explains Clarence Thomas's entire career and explains the career of a lot of these other kind of conservative justices of color or of different status or women conservative justices. That said, make no mistake, as I pointed out in the piece, Trump's judges have been 78% male and 87% white. So,
yes,
he's nominating like his yacht club to the court, make no mistake, but for Ruth Bader Ginsburg in particular, they want Amy Coney Barrett, because she's a woman, to do this work of overturning a woman's right to choose.
Now, let me ask you this, Ellie Mistal, a legal question for you. We just saw Rand Paul get all the credit for shutting down the 9/11 first responders bill. A sitting any member of the Senate can put a hold on a bill and not allow a vote. I guess Mike Lee did it too, but, you know, Rand Paul's getting all the credit here. Can a Democrat do that? Say, for example, God forbid, for some reason, Amy Coney Barrett is now a nominee for the Supreme Court. Can a courageous Democratic senator stand up and block that vote?
So, no, because they took away the filibuster for judicial appointments. The first person who did that was actually Harry Reid. As we were saying earlier, McConnell was blocking all these people for Obama when McConnell was the minority leader.
Right.
So eventually, Harry Reid decided to take away, and by the way, just for the record, I was against this at the time because I could see this coming, but Harry Reid, as Senate Majority Leader, Democrat, took away the filibuster for lower court appointments just so he could get some Obama judges appointed, and
amazing.
So you'd only need a 51 vote as opposed to 60 for lower court appointments. Well, now fast forward to Neil Gorsuch. The lower court appointments have already been removed for the filibuster. Mitch McConnell, to get Neil Gorsuch on the court, had no problem removing the filibuster to require so they were able to get Neil Gorsuch on the court with only 51 votes. And so now Democrats can't obstruct Trump judges in quite the same way that McConnell did. But here's the other problem. And I say this as a resident of New York State who has voted for Schumer in general elections, but not so much in primary. Because what we need from Democrats without the filibuster, without the kind of procedural filibuster, we need the talking filibuster. If they take away the talking filibuster, we need Chuck Schumer to chain himself in the Senate chambers until they stop the pushing forward, ramming through these arch-conservative justices without any liberal support whatsoever. We need Chuck Schumer in the Senate, because it's only a Senate issue, to take a much stronger, harder, everything available kind of protest stand, right? We need him to take a more protest stand against these judges than what he's been doing.
That's an understatement, yes. And I'm glad to hear make the distinction between voting for Schumer in the primaries and in the general. Of course, you can vote for him in the general, but in the primary, I appreciate the fact that you agree, I think, is what you're saying, that we need to go in a more progressive direction. And in fact, this brings me to the article that was posted today on thenation.com that they headlined, "Tom Friedman has no idea what he's talking about." And the subtitle is, "Every pundit urging moderation was wrong in 2016, and they're wrong now." Yes, and this is what I've been saying. We need to get a progressive Congress. We need a progressive person in the White House. I'm very grateful for your position here and for the article you wrote. I don't want to put you in a position to criticize MSNBC. Hopefully they're paying you lots of money. But they're
not a dime.
No. Seriously? You're not a paid contributor over there?
Nope.
Because you're a progressive. Sorry, this is me. I have a thing with MSNBC. They like to promote, you know, the never Trumpers, the Republicans who you don't like Trump anymore, from Tom Friedman down to Bill Kristol to, you know, you name it. Anyway, their posture of the network is decidedly anti-progressive. So I'm wondering if you get any pushback when you say something like this.
No, from the corporate people at MS, no pushback there.
Okay.
No, of course I get pushback, you know, online and on Twitter and in my inbox and probably in my mailbox at some point today. from moderates who really, and I'll give them this, they are just as afraid of Donald Trump as, you know, I am, right?
Mm-hmm.
They desperately want him to lose. They happen to think that the best way to defeat Donald Trump is to give Republicans basically everything they want except Donald Trump, right? Like, they want to cave on every kind of important progressive issue they can think of in hopes that will attract enough Republican votes to defeat Donald Trump. And I think that is just the wrong way to go. I do not think that is the wrong way to go just because I am a progressive and they are moderates. I think that is the wrong way to go because I want to win. and their way of trying to win is not a winning strategy. If you look at we talk about this all the time, but they're basically, to defeat Donald Trump, you got to pick up 80,000 votes in about three states, right? In Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Overall, 80,000 votes, and Trump loses, right? So the moderate wing of the Democratic Party has been telling us since Trump got elected that the way to win is to change the mind of about 80,000 people who already threw their hat in with bigotry, sexism, and now crimes against humanity. Just change their minds, and then we win. No, 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 no. Mm-hmm. Those people are never coming back. They're too far in it now. To use a quote from Macbeth, they are halfway through the river of blood. There is no turning back for them. What we have to do is take 80,000 people who voted for Barack Obama in 2012 but did not vote at all in 2016
exactly,
and figure out how to get
home.
Them back to the polls.
Absolutely.
And the only way you're going to do that is by nominating a strong, progressive candidate who has policies that oppose Donald Trump, not just furrowed brows that oppose Donald Trump. People want action. What they didn't see, what they saw from Obama, was a person who promised change and action. And we have to give them another person who promises change and action.
But we'll deliver on it. Right? But
yeah,
but we'll deliver on it, not just make the promises.
Exactly. You know, like the Democratic strategy in 2020 cannot be vote for Democrats, slightly less racist than Republicans.
Right.
That's not going to work. We have to come up with something better, and that's why I'm saying that the Friedmanites, the David Brookses, the Never Trumpers, they're wrong. They're Republicans. Go. If you want to have an influence in the primary, go vote in the Republican primary, you Republicans.
Right.
Something about Donald Trump there.
I'm sick of Jennifer Rubin chastising me for wanting a progressive to be the nominee. I'm a Democrat. I'm a progressive. You're a Republican. Deal with your own house, right?
I'm going to be in this party long after you go back to peddling whatever neoliberal crap that you usually peddle, right?
Exactly.
This is my home, and so we're going to talk about my issues. Now, when it comes to the general, if we want to pivot a little bit more center, okay, fine. But bottom line, and this is why I wrote the article that you referenced today, bottom line, I invert this whole paradigm that somehow progressives are already made their choice, so we don't have to worry about them. We should only play to the middle.
Right?
No. This election is a moral choice for independents and moderates. And I believe that most of them, not all of them, but a majority of them, will make the correct moral choice so long as the Democrats are making that moral choice obvious and stark. You can vote for a bigot or not. You can vote for a sexual predator or not, Thomas Friedman.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need to hear about what kind of, you know, economic growth zones you need to make to seal the deal. Are you with us or are you with the bigots? That's your only choice. And I think that when you put it to them like that, most of them will make the right choice, or at least enough of them to win. What you then need is to have that real motivation of young people, people of color, women of color. You need that motivation. You need them not just voting. You need them making phone calls. You need them walking the streets. You need them donating money. You need them making their friends donate money. And you're not going to get that with a milquetoast centrist, faux Democratic candidate.
Exactly. You keep calling them moderates. I've got a little problem with that word, because most of who the media calls moderates are actually what I call conservadems. And I would I would give that label to Joe Biden. I'm sorry, I do not think Joe Biden is viable in 2020. I think if he is the nominee, that Donald Trump will wipe the floor with him. You have any thoughts on that?
I do not oppose a Joe Biden candidacy because I am more liberal than Joe Biden. I oppose Joe Biden's candidacy on his own ground of electability.
Right.
I do not think that he is the one who is electable.
Nor do
I think that if we make this election about who can best impress Trump voters, Trump's going to win. He has already proven Trump has already proven that he is better at impressing Trump voters than anybody else. And so if we make this election about the people who like Trump, then guess what? Trump is going to wipe the floor with us.
Yep.
If we make this election about the people who don't like Trump, who never liked Trump, who never cast their hat, who never put on the MAGA hat, well, then I think we have a chance.
Right. No, I agree with you wholeheartedly. I do this show every day. I don't consider myself a journalist. I am an opinion commentator, but my show is firmly rooted in fact. If I ever get anything wrong, I beg people, please correct me, because the last thing I want to do is disseminate bad information. So it's a news-based show, but I am not afraid of giving my opinion. My listeners know exactly where I am. I've been a longtime Bernie Sanders supporter and a longtime Elizabeth Warren supporter. And I'm actually glad, in a sense, that they're going to be in the debate together, because I want to hear what differences there are between them. But I don't think we're going to get any fireworks between them. I think they're going to mostly be in agreement against the John Delaney's and the Beto O'Rourke's and the others on the stage, which is not necessarily a bad thing.
Right. At this point, I don't see why it's even worth it for them to fight. Right?
Right.
Like
not
the,
at all.
Like they are closer together than the other people on that stage.
Right.
And I think what I would really like to see is for everybody on that stage to spend a little bit more time just beating the bag out of Trump this time around than they had spent last time.
Yes. And part of that, of course, are the questions that are being asked. But I worry, based on what CNN did last night to come up with the lineups for the two nights. Did you see any of their big draw?
They turned it into a game show. They turned it into a game show.
It was so embarrassing. It was laughable. I mean, we taped it because we didn't want to have to sit through it. But just even forwarding through it, oh, my God, the tortured way they were, like, shuffling up the tiles in the three different categories. And this anchor did the first one. And, oh, my God, seriously? And they were rewarded with a whopping million people who tuned in for it.
And it was also, like, so obvious that the fix was in, because I was on live with on Sirius, so we were watching it during the commercials, and I said to the host, look, if this comes out with Bernie and Warren on the same night, but Biden and Harris on the same night, and those nights being different, the fix was in all the way. And the fix was in all the way, because what they want for their ratings is to have exactly that kind of Bernie-Warren face-off,
even though
we're both saying, I don't think they're going to face-off.
They won't.
They want for their second night is like Biden v. Kamala too.
Right.
Even though there's almost no chance that Biden or Kamala are going to give them that either. But
exactly.
That's what they want to sell.
That is it.
Of course, that's how it worked out. Totally random, CNN.
Of course.
I believe that.
Of course. All right, we're getting close to the end of the hour. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you your thoughts on the way Nancy Pelosi is handling the question of what to do with Donald Trump. Sorry.
I do not understand why a president who seems to have committed crimes is not being impeached and held accountable for those crimes.
Thank you.
I don't understand that. I don't understand the strategy. I'm told there is a strategy. I'm told there is a grand plan. I don't see it. I don't believe it. I want Congress to do its constitutional duty, not its political duty, not its, CNN game show duty. I want us to do its constitutional duty, which is to hold the president accountable for high crimes and misdemeanors. They are the only body that can do that. And so I want them to do that.
You and me both. Do you hold any, what are your expectations for Wednesday? Wednesday, the 24th, being the day that Mueller finally testifies.
Mueller day.
Yes, it's Mueller day. It's Mueller time.
Yes. Mueller is going to show up on Wednesday, and he's going to have, like, a Roger's thesaurus full of euphemisms for read my report, you idiot.
Uh-huh.
That's all it's going to be. He's going to read his report. When they ask him questions that are not in his report, he's going to say, well, as I said in my report, I refer you to page 275 of my report.
Yeah.
And when they really ask him a question that has nothing to do with his report, he's going to say, well, I didn't investigate that. If I had, it'd be in my report. It's going to be an entire day worth of that. And the only reason this is happening is because the Democrats are under the notion that if people who haven't read the report just hear Mueller slowly talking about the report, that is going to be what happens that's going to move the ball forward on impeachment. See, the thing that I've said, and I've said this a lot of times, the Mueller report, the Democrats were not looking for ammunition in the Mueller report. Because if they were, the Mueller report gave them all the ammunition they needed to impeach Donald Trump. The Democrats were looking for cover. they want Mueller to give them cover. They want Mueller to say, they want Mueller to sit up there on Wednesday and say, you know, y'all should impeach the president.
Yeah.
So they can say, well, you know, it's not really our call, but Robert Mueller says we should, and so we have to. That's what they want. Mueller's not going to give it to them, so I don't really know what Wednesday's about.
Well, I think it depends on how the questions are asked. And according to Gerald Nadler last night, they are working very hard on portioning out the topics and the questions so that they cover a lot of territory. We'll see. I hope he's put on the spot.
I'll watch.
Yes, of course. We'll all watch, and we'll have the popcorn popped. Ellie Mistal, you're a treasure. I'm so happy. Look, I thank MSNBC for introducing you to me because I am a big fan, and I so appreciate your time today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Shoot me an email now that you have it.
I absolutely will. Thank you. Have a great weekend.
All right.
Bye-bye. All right.
Bye.
Ellie Mistal, my new buddy. I'm so excited. All right. I got to go write him an email. Have a great weekend, everyone. I'll see you Tuesday. Keep the faith, baby.